Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer of Northwestern University. The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it. We gratefully acknowledge contributions to sustain the Infrastructure Show from Andrea and Ron DeFeo, Dr. Robert Peskin, and Dr. Raymond Ellis. The Sioux Locks on the Upper Peninsula of Michigan connect Lake Superior and the Lower Great Lakes, and they play an essential role in the U.S. iron ore supply chain. Originally constructed in 1855 and once the busiest locks in the world, the Sioux Locks have been expanded over the century, and the current need for redundant capacity has long been recognized. This year, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Detroit District, which operates and maintains Sioux Locks, released an economic validation study that documents the importance of the lock complex and the economic value of an additional lock. Today we're talking with Lieutenant Colonel Greg Turner, who is commander of the Detroit District for the Corps, about Sioux Locks and their operational and maintenance challenges and the validation study. I'm happy to talk to you this morning, Colonel Turner.
Yeah, and great to talk to you as well.
So first, tell us about the Sioux Locks, because I think a lot of us don't know what they are and where they are.
So your introduction was great. You kind of hit on some of the high points there. But one of the things you mentioned was it connects Lake Superior to the Lower Great Lakes. So, every kid growing up, I think, in elementary school kind of gets an introduction to U.S. geography, including the Great Lakes. But they may not understand how those lakes connect together. So Superior, specifically, is about 23 feet above Lake Michigan Huron, which hydrologically, just one lake, really, they share the same elevation. But so in order to get through that, there's the St. Mary's River that separates Canada from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And specifically, in where the Sioux gets its name from is the French word for waterfalls. And there's about a 21-foot drop in a very short expanse where Sault Ste. Marie was built on. And that's where we built the locks to navigate through 21 feet of those 23-foot drop, just in that very short expanse there.
What happens to the other 2 feet?
Yeah, the other 2 feet, just over the course of, I think St. Mary's River is about 75 miles long, so it's just a natural flow of the river.
And what's the dominant market? That is, why did the rest of the country care about Sioux Locks?
And that's a great question. So the Great Lakes Navigation System itself is a really interconnected system, and it handles something like 130 million tons of commerce each year. And a lot of that, even though the St. Lawrence Seaway connects the Great Lakes to the ocean, a lot of it is really point-to-point within the Great Lakes. And the Sioux Locks really connects the largest of the lakes, Lake Superior, with the rest of the Great Lakes. And that's really important for the system as a whole to keep interconnected. But specifically, and this is maybe what we're getting after here, is why is it so critical, not just an important part, but the important part, or we say the linchpin of the Great Lakes, is because of what's going where. So going back in the history, we had a lot of copper mining in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And since then, a lot of it's been exhausted, but that's moved to Minnesota. So the largest port in the entire Great Lakes is Duluth Superior. And through that port, we get all the iron ore in the form of taconite, which is where we use our iron ore to get the steel that is used in every single advanced high-strength steel factory in the United States. So other factories, all the steel that we use in things like our vehicles, our appliances, and a lot of other things, completely is reliant on the Sioux Lock in one form or another.
So part of the geography that I have to envision in my mind is that Duluth is on Superior, and to get to the other Great Lakes, you've got to go through Sioux Locks.
Yeah, so you might think that, well, why can't you do it by trucks or rail or some other ways. But you have Duluth on the one end of Lake Superior and a number of steel mills spread out across the Midwest and actually even further. Really, the only way to get there by water is through Sault Ste. Marie. Now, again, well, why not just go to rail? Well, the bottom line is the rail infrastructure doesn't exist. When the system was built and steel mills are built, they're built to receive the steel by water. And that said, even if they were built, they can't handle the capacity that the steel industry requires. So we're comparing 1,000-foot, what we call them footers in Great Lakes parlance, 1,000-foot ship is equal to approximately 7 100-car locomotives.
So it's more efficient to move by water.
Yeah, so not only is it more efficient, but really we don't have that rail infrastructure in place. So not just more efficient, but really the only option without completely having a World War II era rebuilding of our American infrastructure.
So what's the plan at Sioux Locks?
So there's a couple parts of the plan. You know, right now we have four locks physically existing on U.S. side, plus an additional lock on the Canadian side. The Canadian lock is a smaller lock, really more for a recreational use. But the four we have on the U.S. side, most recently one was built was in 1968, the Poe lock. So that's the one that's really the important part. And I said before how the Sioux locks are the linchpin. Well, if the Sioux locks are linchpin, then the Poe lock is the Achilles heel. And you talk about a little bit in your introduction about the redundancy is what we're needed and what we're calling for. Because right now, because of those footers I mentioned, can only fit through the one lock, the Poe lock, which is already over 50 years old now. That single point of failure, if something would happen to that lock for any number of reasons, would really grind the U.S. steel industry specifically to a halt. So what are we doing about it is what you're asking. So first, back in 1986, Congress authorized us to build a redundant lock. So I mentioned the four locks on U.S. side and only named one. The other ones are MacArthur lock, which is still in existence, built during World War II, 1943. I believe it opened, so it's just over 75 years old now. That's still great lock in operation, needs a lot of tender love and care, but it's just not big enough to handle the biggest ships. The other two locks I mentioned are the Sabin and Davis locks. Those are both built a generation before the MacArthur during World War I, I think 1914, 1917. And now those are really obsolete and effectively completely out of service. So the plan is to take the space those locks are being used, remove them, and replace the two oldest locks with a new Poe-sized lock in their footprint.
And that's 1,200 feet long by 110 feet wide?
Exactly. It would be the same dimensions, and I like to say call it twinning of the Poe.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that that's the exact dimension of the old locks on the Panama Canal. So apparently that was right size for the Navy at that point in time.
That sounds right. So it's funny you bring that up. Sometimes we've heard a few questions like, why not, if that's the old dimension of the old Panama Canal, why not make it bigger and keep it up with the existing Panama Canal or in some other size bigger? And the answer to that is we simply don't want to be in the same boat we are 10, 20, or 30 years from now that we are in today, where we have one lock that traffic is restricted to and one smaller lock. That's what we think we'll find ourselves in if we build anything bigger than the current Poe.
So that redundancy is really a key benefit that you'd get out of this project.
Yeah, you know what? Yes, but I don't even like using the word redundancy because some people that implies that you have extra or some duplication that could be inefficient. And that actually gets after the name of Department of Homeland Security's report, The Perils of Efficiency. What we need to have a resilient Great Lakes navigation system and to protect the economy as we now know it, we need to have two locks that are capable of handling the traffic on the Great Lakes.
So tell us about the validation study, which I understand is a benefit-cost analysis. Is that fair?
Well, yeah, among other things, it looks at the economic benefit that would be gained by adding a second lock, as well as the cost of doing that lock. So that was a effort that really culminated last summer in June when Mr. James Dalton from U.S. Army Corps of Engineers headquarters signed director's report for that study and came up with the benefit of cost ratio of almost 2.5. I think it was 2.42 to 1, saying that based on different assumptions of future outages and our projected cost for the project, we think that it would turn an investment of almost 2.5 to 1.
So one of the things I found interesting about this study is that you created what I might call three counterfactual options, that is, not options that didn't exist, but could exist and to serve a similar or the same need, and you compared that to the new Poe size lock. Can you talk about those alternatives that you looked at?
Yeah, really, that was one of the things that's kind of unique about this report. With normally when we do reports for a navigation project, we're doing getting the benefit-to-cost ratio based on comparing the cost of building the navigation project, the lock in this case, to alternatives. And I mentioned earlier that there isn't an alternative as far as rail or other means that is feasible, at least without making a lot of assumptions, that we would build out a multi-billion dollar rail system and et cetera, et cetera, or move plants, which just weren't realistic. So we did look at some different options. What could we do? And the one that got the most realistic, because it did provide some alternative for a certain quantity, was the Escanaba port. So there's a port on the Lake Michigan side of the Upper Peninsula called Escanaba, and we really looked at how much capacity it could have and how it could be expanded and looked at stuff, but really that fell apart at some certain points there. You know, a number of assumptions had to be made that just weren't realistic, so we projected beyond there.
One of the options that was described in the report was called a conveyor option, which I thought looked like it was portaging the materials around the locks. Was that considered seriously?
It was considered. Two similar options were considered, as especially if you're looking at scenarios that have a shorter outage. One was, yes, simply a conveyor system where you would take material from one ship and basically cross-load it, portage, but on a conveyor belt across the locks. And the other one was lightening, or from one ship, put it through a smaller ship and have it go through the lock and then just use that smaller ship as a taxi back and forth between the larger ships. Well, the large ships have the capacity to carry it across the lakes. Fewer smaller ships you have just to taxi it back and forth, which is really not too dissimilar to the conveyor system, but again, rapidly break down when you're talking about longer durations and larger quantities. Of course, the cost just to start a conveyor system would be large too, but only effective short term.
So let's talk about the project. So it's another 1,200-foot lock. Is it any different than what we see in the Poe lock?
Yeah, in many ways, the Poe, the new lock will be a twin of the Poe. But we are looking at, technology has changed a lot in the past 50 years. We looked at some different filling systems in order to be able to fill and empty the Poe quicker. So it takes a bit of time to fill and empty the lock. We're talking about millions of gallons of water. So that's one of the things. And then also just other ways to modernize it and make it more a resilient electrical hydraulic system, et cetera. But in many ways, it's the same dimensions that it will be run similar to the way the Poe lock is run.
Would the new lock have miter gates or rolling gates?
Yeah, so originally it was designed to have a vertical lift. We've actually taken that out and replaced it with the miter gate, so it will be a miter gate system. We'll look at the filling system and try to do a, instead of underneath the gates to go in from the side, to use the existing Davis lock as an option to do that. We're looking at investigating whether that would be feasible or not, and that could potentially save us considerable time during the construction if we went with that option.
And when the Corps builds a project of this scale, I assume that you contract it out, that you're not actually doing the building yourselves, are you?
That's right. We'll basically manage both the project and construction. We'll do that in several phases. So what we're working on right now, what we were provided funding for by the federal government already, was for the upstream channel deepening. So the existing locks, said Sabin and Davis, are obsolete. One of the reasons is that because their depth is just over 21 feet, whereas we're looking for a 30-foot depth. That's what we'll work to. And for the upstream channel portion, of course, it isn't that deep yet. So we're going to have to remove not just sediment in the bottom of the channel, but also bedrock because it's where we're at that place in the depth. We'll have to remove quite a bit of both bedrock and sediment.
So that's a drilling and blasting job.
Yeah, so potentially it could be removed explosively, but we're looking at mechanical removal as well. And that's kind of up to the contractor submission.
And the validation study that was done, presumably that was a requisite for getting a favorable decision to go ahead with this project?
No, absolutely. And necessary step. So I said it was first authorized in 1986. Mm-hmm. And so it was authorized for a much smaller amount of money than we think it will cost. But so from this validation study, we estimate it cost $922 million. So that required a new authorization. Because back in 1986, we estimated it was only going to cost $227 million. So whereas we do factor in inflation and assume that we are authorized to do something that's still within the inflated cost. The $922 million is much above that. And that price went up for a number of different reasons beyond inflation. It's a better design of what we're looking for in the lock. Also, I think more realistic contingency of what we can expect as far as the contractor markups and other things like that. But that got us to an authorization. So in the Water Resource Development Act of last fall, 2018, authorized that project at the expected cost of $920, which opened the doors for the federal appropriations to come, and which we've already seen that money coming as early as last November. Yeah, so in addition to the $32 million we got from the federal government and the FY19 work plan, we also got a contribution from the state of Michigan in the form of $52 million. And that's actually really extraordinary because while the original project authorization in 1986 was a cost-shared project, 75% federal, 25% to be shared among the eight Great Lakes states, when the project was most recently reauthorized before 2018, but it was reauthorized again in 2007, it was 100% federally cost-shared, so no requirement for the states to contribute anything. That said, the state of Michigan recognized not only the value to their state, but also the region and the nation, and decided it was worth their investment of $52 million to help accelerate the project. Yeah, so that money was able to, we had to use that money to really get after the upstream channel deepening I talked about. The money we got from the federal government, the $32 million, wasn't in itself enough to complete the upstream channel deepening in its entirety. So it helped us, A, complete that, and we plan on issuing or soliciting a contract. We hope to award that contract in this coming September, with construction starting as early as this fall, but more likely given weather conditions in the springtime. But not only get after upstream channel deepening, but also to really get after the design. So I mentioned we had some design already, but those were a preliminary design of the chamber itself. So, and that's really the critical path for this project, is getting through the chamber design and construction. So it helped us get a restart on the chamber design. And then also we have the approach walls, which are really like the pier walls on the upstream channel. We need to finish design and award that contract too. While the $50 million won't let us get after an award yet, it will let us move those design efforts ahead.
So it sounds like a really interesting project. How long will I have to wait before I can go up and see the construction in progress?
That's a great question. So with efficient funding, which means that federal government or additional contributed funds possibly comes in an amount that we can execute in any given year, should be 7 to 10 years from start of construction. So again, I said construction could start as early as this fall. So we could be seeing a lock opening as early as 2026.
Okay. Well, I'll put it on the calendar. You know, one of the things I've observed is that the Pollocks forever have carried the name of the fellow that, I guess, designed and built it. Do you have any sense that the new locks will have a different kind of name?
Really, traditionally, the locks were been named by act of Congress. So that hasn't happened yet. So I don't think I'll make any comment about the name of the new lock.
So it's out of your hands. Okay. Well, maybe we'll get your name on it.
Yeah, and so one thing I'd like to add is we said it would take 7 to 10 years from start construction to build these locks. But I earlier said we have an Achilles heel. So I guess the question that I would beg to know is, what are we doing in the meantime to keep the existing infrastructure in operations? That's actually our number one priority. As much momentum and energy and attention that the new SULOC is getting, both from Congress, the administration, and the public, that is important to us, but our first priority remains keeping the existing infrastructure and operations. So we put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to that, but specifically for taxpayer money, Congress has appropriated a number of things that we can do. One is what we're calling our major rehab, which picked out four major projects for both the MacArthur and the Pollocks that we're doing. And that was fully funded for a four-year project in advance, which is, for Congress, is somewhat unusual, but it speaks to the trust they have in the Corps of Engineers that we're going to execute the project by giving us full funding up front, which helps us do it faster and more efficiently. So hopefully we won't even need quite all that money if we are able to execute this on time. And then on top of those four major projects, we have a multi-year plan called Asset Renewal, again, looking at other major components of the MacArthur and Pollock that we need to get after. And actually, that's a 15-year plan, 10 of which are in our rearview mirror, and 5 more coming up. That's a total of $190 million, 75 which are still to come and be appropriated. But that's an enormous investment in the existing infrastructure, but it's warranted. It's warranted because we need to keep the Great Lakes Navigation System moving for the next 7 to 10 years. And then even once we build a new lock, if the old infrastructure is falling apart and hasn't been maintained, then we'd still have a single point of failure. It's just the new lock is that single point of failure. And while we reduce the risk of that being that it would be new, it doesn't eliminate that risk. And that's what we're trying to do, is really keep two redundant locks in place.
That seems, that initial investment that you just described is a substantial commitment to increasing the resilience of the Sioux locks until and if you can put that second lock into place. That seems really important for the economy of the Midwest and the economy of the nation.
Yeah, really, it is about the economy of the nation. And while I said earlier I wasn't an expert on the economics, we do see something as short as a two-week unexpected outage at the Sioux, depending on the timing of the year, with the winter stockpiles being drawn down, as being something that would affect the economy across the nation.
But normally the locks are closed in the dead of winter in any case, isn't that so?
That's right. There's a 7-to-8-day period we have from January 15th to March 25th of every year where we shut the locks down for the winter maintenance. And that's the key time where a lot of this asset renewal and major rehab work is going on. It's not restricted to that time, but that's really the best time to get after that. For the shipping industry, of course, for the workers, it can be hard. And this winter has been a difficult one. It's been extremely cold and snowy winter. I think we set a record amount of snowfall in the month of February. But still, we have equipment set up to help us get after that. We have put bucket loaders on the floor of the lock in order to remove the snow, for example.
Yeah, well, those are hard conditions to work in, but then that's a planned outage, so the customers downstream can know that that's going to come every year and they can stockpile and be ready for it.
Absolutely, and that's actually, we talk about different alternatives we looked at in the validation study, and one was simply to increase the size of the stockpiles, and while that would make the system more resilient, again, a limited amount of benefit because you can only make the stockpile so big before even the environmental conditions would degrade the stockpile, taconite or the iron ore, in order to make it less useful for the steel industry.
Well, and not only that, but you don't know how much of a stockpile to create, given that you don't know what the interruption is going to be.
Mm-hmm. It's correct.
Really interesting. I really appreciate your spending the time with us today, Colonel Turner. It's been fascinating to learn about these locks, and I've got it on my list to try to get up there and take a look at them.
Yeah, we're looking forward to getting after this, too, and I'm looking forward to interacting with all kinds of people in the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for listening to The Infrastructure Show. If you enjoyed the conversation as much as we did, please encourage your friends to subscribe to our podcast. The Infrastructure Show is recorded in the Reeves Audio Recording Studios in Evanston, Illinois, under the direction of Jim Reeves, Chief Engineer, with a commitment to great sound. Our producer is Marion Sowers, the journalist with a passion for infrastructure. And I am Professor Joseph Schofer. Few people are more curious about infrastructure than I.